Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the AOMPT Research Podcast. My name is Danu J. Seelan, and today I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Helen French to discuss her paper titled An International Study of Current Physiotherapy Practice in Diagnosis and Knowledge Translation of Greater Trochanteric Pain Syndrome, GTPS, which was recently published in Musculoskeletal Science and Practice. Dr. French is a senior lecturer in the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland, University of Medicine and Health Sciences School of Physiotherapy. She attained her bachelor's in physiotherapy from University College in Dublin, her master's from Trinity College, higher diplomas from Trinity College and RCSI, and completed her PhD at the RCSI. Her clinical and research interests are related to rehabilitation interventions for hip OA and other hip joint pathologies, the role of biomechanics, movement control, and pain mechanisms in hip pathology. Dr. French, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks very much, Dino. Hope all is well there with you.
Obviously, with COVID, our teaching has changed to a virtual environment, and a lot of our research has been shut down, from a clinical research perspective at least. I'm wondering if you might start by telling our listeners kind of how COVID has affected you and your research.
I certainly had a few projects on the go at the time. We locked down in Ireland around mid-March. Our universities closed, our schools closed, and we moved to a virtual campus. So all of our teaching switched to online remote learning. We had to change our exam formats for our practical exams, and then research projects that I had planned had to be deferred. So I was due to start one in April. That was deferred. I had one ongoing in a clinical environment, so that's still on the back burner. Research just has to go on hold. There are some things I think can be done remotely. So, for example, maybe surveys or qualitative research can still continue. But anything where you want to get people in a room and do some physical exams or do some intervention-based research, unfortunately, it's just not practical at the moment for us. But hopefully, over the next few months, as our clinical practices start to return to normal, we can start to consider getting back to our clinical research again.
Delaying clinical research for now is obviously something we have to do to kind of make sure everyone's safe. But it also does highlight that we can also do other types of studies and research. Some of that's qualitative research, and then some of that is survey studies. And so speaking to your survey study, the one we're going to discuss today, do you mind just giving the listeners a background of your study itself?
Yeah. So this was a survey that we conducted in three different countries, in Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland. And actually, the research idea came out of the IFOMT conference back in 2016 in Glasgow, when a group of us from these three countries were talking. We all have an interest in GTPS. And a student of mine, Louise, had done a really nice research protocol for her final year project around this topic. So we decided we'd take it forward and try to look at it internationally. So, you know, it took us a couple of years to just get all our ducks in a row when you're trying to do things across three different countries. So we developed the survey, and we had a lot of questions in it. We had 51 questions in total. So actually, the paper that we're going to mainly discuss today, that was published in Musculoskeletal Science and Practice, really only focuses on some elements of that survey, particularly the diagnosis and knowledge translation. And there is another paper in Physiotherapy Journal that focuses on the management, so the actual interventions that are used by physiotherapists, and that contains more of the responses to those questions. So in total, across the three countries, we had a total of 361 valid responses. And this was circulated to the professional organizations of the three countries, particularly to the musculoskeletal physiotherapists who could have been working in public or private practice. So I guess the main thrust of the the survey was really to try and understand how physios are managing GTPS. I guess it's kind of an evolving condition. There's a lot of confusion around what it is, what it isn't, terminology, and very little evidence around how it's managed. There's only been about three or four systematic reviews, and they all really come to the same conclusions, which are that the evidence is not robust at all for what to do with this condition. And there's been lots of interventions tried and tested. Evidence is not particularly high quality. So we were interested to see, well, what are they doing on the ground? And I think that can often drive future research and drive future randomized controlled trials. So that was kind of the background to why we did the survey. And just to focus on the diagnosis part of it, you know, we asked questions particularly about how they diagnosed it, because knowing that this is a condition that potentially includes different pathologies, so we asked about what symptoms would be most indicative. We asked about what kind of physical exam findings they would use to diagnose it, and the role of imaging. And I don't know if you want me to go into some of the results of that in particular, Dinu.
Sure. Yeah. If you could go into the results, that'd be great.
Yeah. So I suppose the reassuring thing was that we had three different countries and the results were broadly similar across the three countries. And for me, that's always quite reassuring, you know, that we're kind of similar on an international level. So in terms of the symptoms, the two biggest symptoms that people consider to be useful for diagnosing GTPS was lateral hip pain with loading and lateral hip pain with side lying. So reproduction of their pain with some kind of a loading activity. And then that was possibly not, well, more useful than just lateral hip pain on its own. So certainly that's kind of suggestion of there being some kind of a loading or mechanical aggravating factor. And we had a whole list of tests that we asked about, because there are a lot of tests out there. And I think this is sometimes the confusion with this condition, that we have a number of tests. Some of these tests are used for other conditions, and therefore this kind of ability to rule in and rule out can be tricky. But the kind of main test that seemed to be most useful for the respondents was palpation of the greater trochanter, palpation of the gluteal tendon. In terms of actual physical kind of testing, lateral hip pain with single leg stance. So that would be standing on one leg on the leg to be tested, or the symptomatic leg, for 30 seconds with the hip in neutral and the knee flexed, and reproducing the pain. So it's not that you're looking for any, you know, motor control deficit. You're simply looking for reproduction of pain. And other ones that were considered to be more useful or less useful really would have been tests where you're doing resisted hip abduction, fader, which is your flexion adduction external rotation, and flexion adduction external rotation resisted, so where you're adding in a resisted abduction as well. And again, least commonly used tests were some of the tests that have been discussed in other papers, such as the FABER, which is the flexion abduction external rotation, lateral hip pain with Obers, and lateral hip pain with external derotation test. So they seem to be less useful, even though other studies have shown that there is some diagnostic utility in those tests. And then we asked about imaging, so particularly ultrasound and MRI, and these would be used, I suppose, are suggested to be useful for particularly picking up the tendinopathic changes, so the actual changes within the tendons. Ultrasound would also, or they would both pick up, of course, any fluid associated with a bursitis. So, you know, there was a bit of variation, I think, across the three countries with this, in that ultrasound was used more commonly in Australia versus New Zealand and Ireland. MRI, I think, was more consistent. And we also asked about X-ray. And I guess in this context, X-ray is really only useful in terms of ruling out perhaps a joint pathology such as hip osteoarthritis, or if the X-ray is normal, just indicating that there is no hip joint arthritis. So again, that was fairly consistent in terms of people being able to use that in their diagnosis, and that was somewhere between 20 to 30% of respondents across the three countries.
You mentioned that you found a fair amount of consistency between countries, which to me was a little bit surprising. I think it's a good thing, I was just a little bit surprised when you actually look at the numbers. Did anything in the results surprise you? Did you find anything you weren't expecting to find?
I think between countries. I mean, I suppose I'll talk a little bit about the profile of the respondents, because I do think that is a factor. So I think the work setting sometimes dictates how things are managed. So, for example, in terms of private versus public sector, so we saw there was more respondents in Australia and New Zealand working in private practice versus Ireland. And that, not that that's surprising, but I think that might explain some results. So, for example, I think when you come to things like imaging, I'm thinking of Ireland particularly, because that's obviously the country I know best, being from Ireland, but that would dictate perhaps the role of imaging. You know, if there's big long waiting lists for MRI or ultrasound, or if it's costly, if the patient is in the public system, then that might be a reason why they're not requesting imaging. And likewise, if a patient is in a private practice and there is greater access through that in health insurance for imaging, that might be a reason why it's used more readily. I mean, that's pure speculation on my part, but it could be a factor. The other thing maybe was a little bit surprising was the number of treatments that was delivered in different countries. So we certainly saw in Australia and New Zealand, they were more similar. So, for example, approximately 42 to 45% of the, I should flip this and say this a different way. Approximately somewhere, 43% of the New Zealand respondents delivered more than six treatments. 26% of the Australian respondents delivered more than six treatments, but only 9% of the Irish respondents delivered more than six treatments. Again, I'm putting that back down to public versus private sector, health insurance limits, you know, insurance companies limit on the number of treatments. So I was a little bit surprised by that. I didn't think that there would be that much difference in the number of treatments offered. In relation to the consistency in the management and in the diagnosis across the three countries, I'm not that surprised because, well, for starters, we would get a lot of physios from Ireland working in Australia, New Zealand. They train over there. They do a master's over there. They come back and they bring that knowledge. We also have two of the authors on this paper do a lot of teaching on this topic. So Alison Grimaldi was a co-author and Angie Fearon, and they both deliver courses on this topic and they've done a lot of research on it. And they've both come to Ireland and they have delivered their courses in Ireland. So I think that knowledge translation piece that we also talked about in the paper. And I think that can also explain why we saw this consistency, because I think the Irish physios are certainly being influenced by their research and the evidence and the teachings that are coming from the Australians who are doing a lot of research on this.
Now that you mention it, it does make a little bit more sense that there's consistency if the content is being delivered by the same people just in different places. Mm-hmm. But there is still a fair amount of variability among a lot of different things in how many people are using imaging or how many people are doing certain tests. Imaging aside, because I would agree with you that maybe more people would use it if it's more available to them. But some of these clinical tests, there's just so many of them, and you can get a lot of information from one test, kind of lead you in different directions about different conditions. So I'm wondering, based on your expertise, knowing what we know about GTPS, what would you consider to be the best diagnostic tools to use for GTPS in the clinical setting?
Yeah, and again, I'm going to actually go back to previous studies in the area, and again to kind of reference my co-author, Alison Grimaldi, who was a lead on another paper, and they did a really nice paper where they looked at the utility of clinical tests. And I think this is probably the most robust paper on this so far. There have been a few other studies that have tried to look at the diagnostic accuracy of some of these tests. This one was published in 2016. So looking at their study, certainly the single leg stance pain reproduction test was found to be quite high in terms of both sensitivity and specificity, and also palpation. I mean, you know, simple palpation. Sometimes we possibly forget to palpate because we've all these other fancy tests. And certainly I was always taught, you know, in the way in my musculoskeletal teaching that, you know, you palpate at the end to confirm, you know, you don't go in and palpate straight away and be misled by the palpation, but the palpation should really confirm all of the other things. But I guess we would expect, I think, with a tendinopathy, we'd certainly see it with other tendinopathies, we would expect there to be tenderness over the structure. And as well as palpating the greater trochanter, also palpating the gluteal tendon. I think the other tests really are using the principle of trying to apply some form of tensile or compressive load. Again, that would make sense with the tendinopathy. If we look at other tendinopathies in the lower limb, usually we'll apply some form of contraction, really, perhaps is more useful than stretch or tensile load. So personally, I think if I was to pick any tests out of that, I would try to pick tests that were using that principle. So I think the fader and the fader or, which is really taking a tensile load and then adding resistance to add further load through compression, I think is probably a one to put on the list. So that's your flexion, adduction, external rotation. And then you can seamlessly go into a flexion, adduction, external rotation, or which is resisted. So they would, you know, for me, they would be a good, robust set of tests. I think the Faber test has some value. So the Faber test was also found to be of value, of some diagnostic utility in differentiating from a hip OA. I think with the Faber, you know, other studies have shown it can be positive in hip OA. It's a combined movement test. But I think in something like a hip OA, what you're more likely to pick up actually is the restricted movement. So some loss of range of movement and possibly the end feel will be different. So the location of the pain would also be important because, again, we'd be looking for lateral hip pain with a GTPS, but with a hip OA, well, it could be lateral, but it could be groin pain, could be anterior thigh pain. So, you know, I think routinely I would do the Faber anyway if somebody came in with a hip problem, because it would be part of my ruling out and differentially diagnosing and trying to reason, you know, and rule out hip joint pathology.
Actually, a lot of pain conditions can kind of overlap. So a lot of things can kind of lead to lateral hip pain. So for me, that's one of the reasons why palpation seems to be so essential as component of my physical exam, especially if I'm thinking about something like tendinopathy. Because with tendinopathy, obviously, this localized pain upon palpation, pain with dynamic loading, pain with resisted testing or stretching, all those things tend to be pretty characteristic of tendon problems. I know one thing that's kind of coming up in the literature more recently, and there's a lot of conflicting evidence, depends on the type of tendon, the body location, all those types of things. In some cases, there seems to be a correlation between altered central pain processing and tendinopathy. And again, it depends on the tendon, upper body versus lower body, but actually GTPS has been linked to central sensitization in some cases. And one of your studies actually found one of those correlations. And so back to the original point of the diagnosis, do you feel like the validity of palpation is changed for people with tendon dysfunction in the presence of altered central pain processing? Tenderness seems to be so widespread, and maybe local dysfunction might not be as diagnostic.
My short answer is yes. My long answer is we don't really actually have the evidence. So I did another study. It was a small scale study that was comparing people with GTPS and people without. And, you know, there was 18 per group, and we did do just some fairly basic quantitative sensory testing tests. We really just did pressure pain thresholds. And we also used the CSI, which is the central sensitization inventory. And within the people with GTPS, we did find a kind of a subgroup, small group, who did have the symptoms of central sensitization. And then there was certainly higher than average or higher than the control group PPTs, but you know, it was a very small scale study, and I think we need to do more. I think we need to do more to understand the pain pattern or the pain pathophysiology in GTPS. Certainly, we know that a lot of these people can have pain elsewhere, and they can have, you know, back pain, for example. They can have associated hip OA. I think that, well, again, this is my opinion. I'm not saying this is kind of really hard evidence, but I think if you look at the gluteal tendons versus the, let's say, the Achilles and the patellar tendons, which are the other two big lower limb tendinopathies, I think which a lot of people use to form their base, they form their treatment decisions for you know, the lesser known tendinopathies like GTPS. You know, we're kind of driven by the Achilles and the patellar tendon research, but they're quite different tendons. If you look at the alignment and the anatomy of the gluteal tendons and where they're over, what structures they're overlying, and then we see the patellar and Achilles tendons, which are these, you know, vertical tendons with a completely different loading type of a pattern. So that's the first thing. I think we've got to be careful about extrapolating from other tendinopathies that we know more about. I think where the gluteal tendons are positioned, you know, we've got that lumbo-pelvic hip control and dynamic between these three areas, very complex. We know the important role of the gluteal tendons in maintaining frontal plane stability. So for lots of reasons, I think there's definitely a possibility of central sensitization and all, you know, altered pain processing, whatever kind of form that takes. But really, I think we need to do more research to definitively determine that. I think we've already seen it in other hip pathologies. Again, it's pretty well established in hip OA. But we haven't really seen that definitive evidence, I think, from the literature. But if we extrapolate from what we know about other central pain processing problems, yes, I would expect that the palpation would be different, and I would expect you would have a wider area of tenderness. I think that's we see that a lot with other altered pain processing conditions. Again, I think we just don't have the research. I mean, nobody's kind of mapped out like on a body chart where these pain patterns are and then tried to match them to measures of central sensitization, such as QST. So I think that would be really, really nice research to do. And I think then we could start to think about whether or not altered pain processing is a significant problem in this group of people.
There's a lot of opportunities for additional research in this area. Coming back to your paper, a number of people primarily rated hands-on experience or hands-on learning as their primary mode of acquiring new knowledge. Is it possible that some of our knowledge might not be appropriately acquired if we're confirming our own biases or if we're not using reflective practice?
Yeah, so this was in relation to the questions we asked about how they acquired their knowledge of GTPS. And I suppose just to summarize what we found across the three countries. So hands-on experience was considered the most important source of knowledge acquisition, and that was higher than a course attendance, journals and conferences, which were the next kind of few options. So, yeah, look, I think that hands-on experience is absolutely critical. You know, we learn by doing, we have a reference point, we remember the patient, we remember how they responded. However, I think it has to be supported further. And again, I'm thinking of, you know, my days when I was clinical and we had a very good supervision system in the hospital we worked in. We used to have these clinical supervision sessions, these buddy sessions, where we would sit down with more junior therapists, and there was the kind of a reasoning part of the supervision session. And I think, you know, as part of that, you have to reflect. So, you know, I'm a big believer in the reflective practice. We teach it a lot with our students as well. So it's all very well getting hands-on experience, but I think you have to take a step back and you have to reflect and use whatever tools work, you know, in the context of what you're doing. And I guess sometimes this is a luxury in a very busy clinical practice. You can't do this for every patient, but certainly patients where they're not responding to treatment You're having to look at, see, you know, what is actually going on here. So I think that notion of stepping back, using a reflective tool, using a clinical reasoning form, whatever it helps to just go back and do that kind of reflection on action, discussing it with a senior therapist, I think is part of that. So I think the hands-on experience on its own is fine. I think it certainly has a role to play, but I think to get the extra benefit, I think it does need to be more than that. And again, I'm just basing that on my own experiences working clinically and now working as an educator.
I would agree that mentorship is a huge component of being able to more rapidly translate knowledge into practice. Having gone through fellowship myself, educating doctoral students, residents, fellows, and clinicians, being able to bounce ideas off of someone and having someone else identify those gaps is really huge. I kind of want to speak to one of your companion papers in 2019, Physiotherapy, where the survey study was done, but it was looking primarily at what's the treatment for GTPS. A number of respondents actually mentioned that they would integrate corticosteroid injections into the management, whether it be a standalone or maybe multimodal. There's actually been a number of well-performed studies at the hip to show that in the short term, sometimes there's maybe some pain relief, but long-term outcomes actually aren't very good, and in some cases are actually worse than not doing anything. I think this is a good example of outcomes not being as good when knowledge translation doesn't occur more rapidly. And so now I'm thinking, besides the mentorship, what kind of tips do you have for newer grads, students, residents, fellows, or their mentors to try to help facilitate that knowledge translation a little bit more rapidly?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, even when I was talking about the hands-on experience, I think, you know, it has to be tied in with the evidence, you know, so we still have to use the evidence that we have, and bearing in mind we may not have the best evidence or the kind of all the answers, but we still have to use that in conjunction with the you know, with the patient in front of us. You know, it always goes back to the little triad of the evidence-based practice that I kind of see kind of sits in my mind every time I'm teaching, you know, that we have that kind of clinical experience, and we have the patient perspective, and we also have the evidence itself, you know, the scientific evidence. So you know, I think that that point about the steroid injection is an interesting one. I mean, one thing to note, we did this survey, well, we submitted the survey or sent it out to the different respondents. This was before the LEAP trial was published. And the LEAP trial is probably the one big trial now that has shown that that the education and exercise was more effective in terms of pain and general global effect than steroid, both in the short term and long term. And that's a little bit different to some other tendinopathies, where steroid injection showed a short-term benefit over exercise, but not the long-term benefit. So that was kind of, I think, pretty clear evidence. There is another interesting randomized control trial that looked at steroid injection, true steroid injection versus sham steroid injection. And this was called the gluteal trial. And they found that there was no extra benefit of the true steroid injection over the sham, which I suppose is kind of reassuring, and that would fit with the kind of evolving evidence that we have that there are changes in the tendon and there it's less of a bursitis. So I suppose, how do we try to translate that then into therapists, you know, kind of, you know, using the best evidence then for their practice? I think when we look at the paper itself, the other question we asked around the use of steroid injection was kind of why. What was their decision making around steroid injection? And the kind of most common answers really were around it providing a window of opportunity for exercise, trying to reduce pain. And certainly it was recognized that it was to be provided with active treatment. So I think, you know, these responses suggest that they see that patients need something. Obviously, there are patients with very high levels of pain, and the pain may be limiting their ability to do their rehab, you know, their exercise and so on. So, yeah, look, I think, again, we need to do more here on this. You know, anecdotally, I hear from my colleagues, I hear it from my rheumatology colleagues, I hear it from, you know, doctors, medical colleagues, GPs, that, you know, steroid injection is still top of their list. We don't have any kind of really robust evidence to show that that's the case either. But, you know, we do have to consider what our medical colleagues are doing, or maybe what they're saying to the patient. Maybe the patient is influencing the decision. Maybe the patient is requesting a steroid injection because they've been advised by their doctor. So, you know, I think there's a lot more work we need to do here about the kind of other healthcare professionals' management of this condition. And also patients' perspectives, you know, when patients are going to see their doctor, what do they think is wrong? Or their physio, what do they think is wrong? What have they been told is wrong? You know, are they already going in thinking, oh, yeah, I need a steroid injection? So, I think there's an awful lot more to be done here to fully understand why this would still be considered to be, a valid treatment. Now, having said that, I think in that paper, where we went into more detail on the physio interventions, I suppose just to kind of reassure your listeners that we did ask them what were the main physio interventions used, and 100% of them said education, and 99%, pretty much 100%, said exercise. So that was, for me, reassuring that certainly they were the top two. Other things that were used, which I kind of wonder about the validity of, the manual therapy and massage, some of those responses didn't quite fit the pathology as well, because in the survey we gave them a definition of GTPS, and we kind of said it was a standalone problem, like tendon problem, as opposed to being a complex problem with joint signs, and yet they were still deciding manual therapy for the hip and for the lumbar spine were kind of in their repertoire of skills. And massage, soft tissue massage particularly. So we're still, you know, seeing modalities that are being used very commonly, which again, there's no evidence, but also there may not be a massive kind of, let's call it biological plausibility. You know, it may not fit with the actual pathology of the condition. So I don't think it's just steroids that we kind of need to think about being the inappropriate modality here. I think there might be other elements of our physiotherapy intervention that may not be the most appropriate.
And not to discount personal experience or what's worked for you in the past, but sometimes we do use some interventions just kind of based out of habit, and I'm sure there's different ways we can streamline our interventions to be more effective, hopefully by using evidence. I also think it's important to consider that knowledge translation isn't as easy as just picking up an article, reading through it, integrating it into your practice, and calling it a day. Understanding when it fits, when it does not fit, understanding that patients are bringing their own opinions that are maybe counter to the evidence, they're getting opinions that are counter to your thoughts from other practitioners. So knowledge translation is a process, and it's not an easy one for sure. Otherwise, a lot of these studies wouldn't say it takes more than 17 years to get things translated into practice. I think these challenges with knowledge translation really highlight the importance of works like yours, which basically create a snapshot of current trends to identify what's going on, what's not going on, and specifically in this case, how are we diagnosing a condition? Are there different ways we could do it better based on available evidence? And if that is the case, how are clinicians getting information? Could it be delivered in a different way that's more effective? So that's really important, and I appreciate your work because I think it gives us a solid foundation to work from. And then going off of this work, do you mind kind of filling in the listeners to any additional work you might have going on kind of related to this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So one of the projects I had actually started, unfortunately, I think I recruited one patient and then we had to shut down. But anyway, never mind. That's life. One study I wanted to do was to just build on the study I had done around the central sensitization. And I wanted to look at, you know, again, in a population of people with GTPS, look at the other coexisting conditions. And this was actually driven by my clinical colleagues who had said to me, look, we're seeing so many of them, they're coming in with spinal pain, or the doctors are kind of referring them in with spinal pain. But actually, when we examine them, they have a really strong component of GTPS. So I wanted to do a study to look at, the central sensitization, the kind of coexisting back pain, and how their physiotherapy, just the regular physiotherapy management, it's not an RCT really, it's an observational study, how that might influence their pain. Again, seeing, you know, would this some of these sensitization features change? Well, they have to exist in the first place, of course, but could they change with just regular physio? And the regular physio would be that education and exercise predominantly. So that was one study, which again, I'm not sure if and when I'm going to get that back on and running, but that would certainly one. And you know, look, I've got lots of ideas of things that I just need to try and get done. I think the patient's perception is really important. So again, we were planning to do some qualitative work about trying to understand the patient's knowledge, the patient's perception of what this condition is. Again, going back to what I talked about a few minutes ago around, you know, maybe what they're hearing from the doctor, what when they're going to the physiotherapist. You know, I think sometimes physios are associated with this kind of hands-on approach. So a patient may expect a hands-on approach, even if it's not necessarily the best evidence. So, you know, again, kind of teasing that out in a qualitative format. So yeah, they'd be kind of the two big ones I'm currently doing. Well, doing, but well, not doing, but hoping to do as soon as COVID allows me to move on. But, you know, there's just, you know, there's so much to be done here, and it becomes really, you know, obvious when you're reading the literature and you're reading the systematic reviews, and you're seeing just there's really just so little evidence compared to other tendinopathies. And there's so many fields or avenues you can go down with this topic. So, you know, I think it'll keep me busy, hopefully for another while anyway, trying to. You know, figure out this pathology a bit more and how we can manage it better, but also how we can improve the translation of knowledge, not just to physios, but actually to our medical colleagues. I still think in Ireland particularly, we still have a lot of maybe not the knowledge of what it is. It's still kind of the trochanteric bursitis would still be, you know, commonly used, and the physios still get the referrals, and it's called trochanteric bursitis on the referral. So we still have a bit of a way to go with that, I think. And we certainly, I think physios are well placed to do that knowledge translation, that education of our medical colleagues, because if you look at a lot of the research in this field, it has been done by physios. And I think we are very, very good at managing and tendon pain. I think a lot of the tendon research is emerging from physiotherapy. So I think we're well placed to educate our medical colleagues on that.
I'm glad to hear there's more in the pipeline, because I think the work you're doing is really important in terms of knowledge translation, especially with the challenging condition. And for our listeners that are interested in finding out more information about your work, is there a way they can get into contact with you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I have a Twitter handle, so it's just at Hel French, HelFrench. I have an email address, hfrench@rcsi.com. It would be very easy just to Google Helen French, physiotherapist, Dublin. I suspect I'd pop up on Google. And look, if you had any listeners out there who are interested in doing research on this topic, as I said, I have collaborators in Australia and New Zealand. No collaborators in the US. So that would be, you know, if there's any of your readers out there who are interested in doing research on this and would be interested in doing something on an international level, because I think that's really important that we do kind of get that global perspective. You know, again, feel free to reach out to me and I'd be happy to chat to you.
And so, Dr. French, just wanted to say thank you again for taking the time to chat with me today. It's really important, I think, to get your perspective on this work, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of your work in the future.
Yeah, and thank you very much for letting me talk about my studies. And as I said, I hope they will be of some use to your listeners. So thanks very much, Dinu.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AOMT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.